This is Dealing with Diabetes, three stories of ethnic communities coping with an epidemic. I'm Pamela Wu. It is estimated that about 25 million American adults have diabetes, a disease that's preventable in most cases. Diabetes is hitting hardest in communities of color, where access to health care and healthy choices can be limited by income, education, and geography. For many people in these communities, diabetes isn't just a diagnosis. It shapes who they are and how they live their lives.
I found out when I was diabetic when I was 21 years old, and I didn't take care of it for 12 years. I was eating unhealthily. I was not taking medications. I was drinking, smoking. I changed my diet and my discipline of myself long before I found out about the damage, but the damage had already been done.
It was shocking because when I found out that I would have to be on dialysis, I was in the hospital for something else. And they said, do you know your kidneys are not functioning? I said, well, what do you mean? You know, I'm going to the bathroom fine, but that was in 2001. And by 2005, the kidneys were gone. And I was not prepared for it.
He was dizzy, and sometimes he would even pass out. Then he went and sought out the doctor. The doctor told him that his kidney was only working at 14%. And the doctor also told him that if he didn't get dialysis going for him, then he would probably die within days or a few months.
There are three types of diabetes: type 1, or juvenile diabetes, gestational diabetes, which can happen during pregnancy, and type 2, or adult onset diabetes, which accounts for more than 90% of all cases. Though preventable, type 2 diabetes is now an epidemic driven largely by environmental factors and lifestyle choices. Among California's African American, Native American, and Hmong populations, a diagnosis of diabetes has life-threatening consequences. But culturally based approaches to healthcare are lengthening and saving lives. In this program, you'll hear how family, friends, culture, and community come together to shape our lives, for better or for worse.
Diabetes can be very, very devastating, so it's not a benign disease.
Dr. Rodney Hood is an internal medicine specialist in San Diego and one of the foremost experts on diabetes in California. He says African Americans, Native Americans, Asians, and Latinos have higher rates of diabetes than anyone else.
However, most scientists believe the diabetic epidemic in the minority population is mostly influenced by lifestyle and environmental factors. Communities they live in many times have poor food choices. They have inability to do adequate physical activity, resulting in obesity.
Dr. Hood says most people who develop diabetes already have some type of underlying genetic predisposition.
But they won't develop diabetes unless exposed to what I call toxic environment, an environment that's exacerbated by poverty, poor access to health care, poor access to healthy food choices, poor lifestyle activities, exposure to certain toxins and drugs. I think it's the environmental social factors that are more important in the diabetes epidemic than the genetic component.
If you're going to talk about diabetes, one community has to be part of the conversation.
The African American community has one of the highest death rates from diabetes than other communities.
The American Diabetes Association reports that almost 5 million African Americans in the U.S. have diabetes. Capital Public Radio healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone takes us to a community gathering in South Sacramento to meet families who are dealing with diabetes.
On a Saturday afternoon in this Sacramento school gymnasium, dozens of people gather around cafeteria tables covered with paper cloths. They eat white cake and cold cuts and share stories. But it's not a celebration. It's a commemoration of people they've lost.
We're at the DaVita Circle of Life Memorial for the patients that have passed away these past couple years.
Shalon Lang is mourning her mother, Katie Jones. After her mother's kidney failed 3 years ago, she got dialysis at a Sacramento center.
She passed away this year at the age of 79 from end-stage renal disease. the cause of that was long-term diabetes.
The burden of diabetes is not evenly shared. While the overall rate of diabetes in the U.S. is just over 8%, almost 13% of African Americans have been diagnosed. And Black diabetics are twice as likely to die from the disease.
And yet, as death diminishes, love enhances.
As images of lost loved ones are projected on the gymnasium wall, caretakers walk to a microphone to share stories.
Anyone else like to come up and share their story?
Shalon's mother needed convincing to begin the life-saving treatments.
I just want to say that for our families and friends that have been on dialysis, they are true champions. They're true heroes. Dialysis is no joke.
Many diabetics with failed kidneys spend half their days sitting in dialysis chairs. Their blood must be cleansed of toxins their kidneys can no longer remove. Just over 200,000 diabetics in the U.S. were on dialysis or had a kidney transplant in 2008 because of renal failure. For most, dialysis is an exhausting and burdensome process, but it prolongs life. Dialysis patients often spend so much time at the centers, they form bonds with others like them.
Hi, darling.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Carolyn Jackson is one of 185 patients treated at this dialysis center in South Sacramento. She's diabetic. She's been going three times a week for years. Today, she comes with blanket in hand to keep her warm through the long treatment.
So I always have my bag and my phone. Keep contact with the outside world for the 4 hours and 25 minutes that I'm in there.
The scene is sobering. Patients filter in and out using canes, wheelchairs, arriving in subsidized transportation. Uncontrolled diabetes can lead to severe complications, gum disease, lower limb amputation, or blindness. Carolyn looks young and healthy compared to many of the others here today. She walks into the center on her own two feet. At her home in Sacramento, Carolyn talks about the struggle to manage diabetes.
You know, some people, you know, I hate going in. I don't like it either. But if I want to live, I have to go. I call it my job to go for dialysis. I tell the kids, oh, I'm getting ready to go to work. You know, see you later when I get home.
Diabetes is the main reason Carolyn quit working in her early 50s. Lost productivity from diabetes in the U.S. amounted to more than $58 billion in 2007. Even when Carolyn was working and raising her kids, she said it was hard to afford healthy food on her income.
Foods that are good for you are too expensive. We cannot afford it. Fruits and vegetables are sky high. I love my fruits and vegetables, but, you know, it's tough. You have no choice to get the frozen food, the frozen pizzas. Try to feed the kids.
More than a quarter of African Americans in the U.S. live in poverty. Carolyn says poor diet is a main cause for the high rates of diabetes in Black communities.
Pound cake, peach cobbler, things like that. Yep, it's about food. You know, years ago, you know, that's the way you show the person how much you love them by cooking for them.
Carolyn has worked to change her diet. On a Wednesday night after dialysis, she demonstrates cooking one of her healthy meals. Carolyn walks around the kitchen with a large white bandage on her upper forearm, a reminder of the day's treatment.
Making chicken stir fry, I put in the soy sauce, garlic, and I'm gonna let that boil for a few minutes.
Carolyn lives with three of her four adult children. Diabetes runs in the family, and she's trying to be a role model.
Brenda does not have it. Michael is borderline, but Andre has it. And my mom had it, and my dad had it also.
Members of the family take turns cooking. When it's Carolyn's turn, she's mindful of her children's health.
Don't fry as much as I used to. One son, Michael. Well, how am I going to fix chicken today? Oh, Mom, can you fry it? Nope, can't do it. Nope, can't do it. Either boil it, bake it. Roast it, barbecue it, whatever. But I'm not going to fry it.
She says what ends up on the table still depends on what's on sale at the store. But every meal does come with a vegetable. As she eats her dinner, Carolyn worries about her 29-year-old son, Andre. He was diagnosed with diabetes a few years ago. and she says he has no health insurance and is not taking care of himself the way he should.
Drinking the sweet drinks and not monitoring himself. And I don't want him to turn up like I did, not knowing that I was a diabetic all those years and not taking care of myself properly. Then maybe I wouldn't have had the damage in my eyes. You know, I don't want him losing a limb.
Carolyn's daily activities are limited to mostly dialysis and church. But she wants to use the energy she has to spread awareness of the disease to young people in her church and beyond.
You know, I might have a disease, but the disease does not have me. My grandkids, you know, I want to be around for them, you know, so I have to, you know, take care of myself for them.
Diabetes isn't just a physical health issue in the African American community. It's having a social and psychological impact.
As the numbers rise, we have more and more families affected by the disease in terms of amputations, in terms of renal failure, in terms of obesity, and then psychologically just the worry in our communities about whether or not we're going to get it.
Brenda Darcel-Lee is executive director of the California Black Health Network in Sacramento. She says diet is a big part of why so many African Americans suffer from diabetes, and the roots of this diet go back generations.
When Africans left Africa and were brought over to this country via the Middle Passage, there was a lack of nutritional food on the slave ships, and in some cases, not enough food at all. Once they were here, they were subjected to foods that were not nutritious in any way whatsoever because they were really given what was left. Most of the foods were starchy, they were fatty, and a lot of pork, which is high in both sodium and fat. As slaves began to inculcate those kinds of foods into their diets, you saw a rise in the kinds of diseases that were prevalent in those days in the African-American community. A lot of that diet was carried over even after emancipation. Mm-hmm. A lot of folk call it soul food or Southern cooking, but really it started back in slavery. And so you find a lot of high starchy foods in our diet, fried foods, and not as many fresh fruits and vegetables. That is a challenge for us, especially in low-income communities. Prime example, you can go to Oakland, right here in California, and go for blocks and blocks and blocks and not find a grocery store that offers fresh fruits and vegetables. That's a problem.
What healthcare interventions are really working for the Black community, and are some of those interventions coming from the community itself?
Absolutely. I think that as over the last few years, as the issue of diabetes in our communities has been raised, we see more and more organizations getting involved in this issue and trying to make a difference. California Black Health Network, if I could plug my own, is one. The American Diabetes Association, I have to give them credit. On their website, they now have a section focused on African Americans. There are a lot of organizations, even NAA and Urban League, that are now looking at ways to address that issue. The California Black Chamber of Commerce, they've addressed diabetes as one of the major challenges in our community.
What policy changes do you recommend for the state or nation to help support the Black community in combating this epidemic?
We are very much in support of the Affordable Care Act, and we are very much pushing for its implementation in the state of California because we believe that it's so important that it's implemented here. So that other states follow suit. And the reason that I say that is because there are components of the act that deal with prevention and wellness. And I think that that is really the clear way to go as you address diabetes. We need to begin to change mindsets and the understanding of what you have to do so that you don't get the disease. So I think that's real important. Another is access to fresh fruits and vegetables in communities throughout the state. And we will continue to work with the Legislative Black Caucus and the state legislature to make sure that that happens in the long run. I also think that it's important that there be more incentives for businesses to cover prevention and wellness in their insurance programs. I hope that the Health Benefits Exchange, as they look at how insurance is going to be managed in this state in the long run, I hope that they begin to look at prevention and wellness as a key component of stemming this tide of rising chronic disease in African American communities.
Brenda Darcel Lee is executive director of the California Black Health Network. You can download transcripts of full-length interviews with experts on diabetes and see video profiles of Carolyn Jackson and others featured in this program at capradio.org/dealingwithdiabetes. Next, how Native American diabetics are learning to make healthy choices for life. I'm Pamela Wu. This is Dealing with Diabetes from Capital Public Radio. This is Dealing with Diabetes, three stories of ethnic communities coping with an epidemic. I'm Pamela Wu. Native Americans are being devastated by diabetes, but the community is taking steps to fight the disease in ways unique to their cultural traditions. Many are realizing their health is directly tied to the choices they make in life. Like at the grocery store, where the choice between broccoli and biscuits could mean the difference between life and death.
All right, everybody, let's come over here.
This superstore in suburban North Sacramento is packed with a mind-boggling 16,000 food products.
Really, there's a lot of choices, so spending some time looking at the different options is a good idea.
That's Kathy Carmichael, a registered dietitian at the Sacramento Native American Health Center. Today, she's leading a group of American Indians through the store. They are all diabetic or related to someone who is. Reporter Pauline Bartolone takes the story from here.
Kathy Carmichael's goal is to teach this group how to make food choices that will help them manage or prevent chronic disease.
We're going to start out in the produce section.
Carmichael stands out from the rest of the group. She's tall, fit, and white. The group of about a dozen Native American folks gather loosely around her. Most of them are older and move slowly. One woman wears turquoise jewelry, another pajama bottoms and slippers. The men wear baseball caps.
So, pumpkins. High-carbohydrate or low-carbohydrate vegetables.
Carmichael weaves aisle to aisle, talking carbohydrates. The more carbs, the higher the blood glucose. That's a danger for diabetics.
Your green beans, your broccoli, your cauliflower, your spinach, those you can pretty much eat as much as you want because the carbohydrates...
Carmichael gives advice about reading labels and eating healthy on a budget. The U.S. Census shows more than a quarter of American Indians live below the poverty level. That's less than $11,000 a year. As they stroll through the oil section, one shopper spots a bucket of lard.
Yeah, that's what we used to eat when we were younger.
Yeah?
Yes. Yeah.
How did you cook it?
Yeah. We saw fire eggs in it, fire meat.
More than 16% of Native American adults in the U.S. have diabetes. That's about twice the rate of the overall population. And nearly one in three Native Americans are in pre-stages of the disease. Type 2 diabetes shortens lives and increases mortality risk. So Carmichael's education here is a matter of life and death.
And I don't go home with everyone and sit at their kitchen table. But I think going to the grocery store, walking together, talking together, that's really where the behavior change begins.
But behavior is not so easy to change. Mary Morla uses a large empty cart as a walking aid as she strolls past the big goods.
I love that. Them donuts.
Mary and some of her family members have been getting Carmichael's nutrition advice for years. But they say grocery store items are expensive. They confess to eating fast food without shame.
It's hard to diet. You never ever heard that word when we were growing up, diet. Now that's the first thing a doctor say when you go see him, diet.
Mary seems to understand her diabetes is related to her choices and her upbringing. But she also describes it as a fate over which she has little control.
We're all going to die one day.
We see the diabetes already taking our eyes, our feet.
Yeah. Slowly but surely.
You can tell now it's going through her mind.
And like I said, it's only up to the Lord. When, where, how, time, place. No one can stop it. He got the plan already. That's how I believe it. Yeah, we don't take care of ourselves. We don't diet. We don't exercise. We know the consequences. But sometimes you just say in your mind, you don't give a damn. If it happens, it happens.
The shopping trip is part of what's called a diabetes talking circle. It's a support group led by Carmichael at the Sacramento Native American Health Center.
All right, so let's do our introductions. If you want to share something that you've been working on in managing your life with diabetes, you can share that.
They meet here to share and learn from a mix of peer support and health education.
I'm Salish from Montana. My diabetes is doing really good. I had it for 1990. Level this morning of 89. I checked out before 89.
The Native tradition of the talking circle was adapted by an American Indian health worker to help combat diabetes. One study shows the model helps increase healthcare compliance, decrease feelings of fatalism, and reduce obesity. Kathy Carmichael says 175 people have taken part in the Sacramento Circle since it started a few years ago.
Providing social support is one of the best things we can do as a community health center, because then our community members know they're not going at it alone. And there's most likely someone else in the community who has a similar problem. You know, someone else who lives in a trailer with a small refrigerator, or someone else who has really high blood sugars and cannot figure out how to control them. And I can provide the place, but I think the stories and the information and education that comes from the talking circle is much better than any information that I can provide.
My diabetes has been dormant for 6 years now.
This talking circle is funded through a federal diabetes initiative for Indians. It's one of over 400 Native diabetes programs across the country. The Indian Health Service says since 1997, they have collectively brought down blood sugar and cholesterol levels and improved kidney function in the Native population.
All right, thanks, everyone.
Here in Sacramento, Talking Circle participants are at different levels of disease management and behavior change. Carmichael again.
Motivation is hard for some people. There are so many health problems or environmental problems, familial problems that people are dealing with, and it's a hierarchy of needs. What's going to help me the most today? Sometimes people come in my office and we plan on having a nutrition counseling session, but they don't have any heat. So I help them figure out how to get the heat turned back on, because that's a priority.
Eddie Mendez. I live in Sacramento, California, 39 years old, am Native American, and currently disabled.
Eddie Mendez has been dropping in on the Diabetes Talking Circle for a few years and says it helps to be around other people struggling with the same illness. He's young, but has a lot of wisdom to share with elderly diabetics.
This is my apartment. This is my wheelchairs. I have two wheelchairs.
In his one-bedroom apartment in downtown Sacramento, he talks about growing up with a single mom. He says they didn't have the nutrition education or the income to make healthy choices.
My mom raised me on Kool-Aid and potato chips and stuff like that. I didn't go to the doctors as a kid. My mom worked under the table, and I didn't have health insurance. I had asthma and allergies and earaches a lot. She just, you know, didn't have the means at the time. We were poor.
Eddie was 21 when his doctor broke the news about his diabetes.
He told me it was a very serious illness, that I needed to control my eating, my sugar intakes and carbs and stuff, but I didn't, at that time, didn't care.
For more than a decade, Eddie didn't take care of his diabetes. He says he did everything a diabetic shouldn't do. He ate poorly, smoked, drank, did drugs. He didn't take medication. Then a life-threatening injury changed everything.
I was swimming at the river, walking on barefooted, which your diabetic isn't supposed to do, and I slid on some gravel hill. Like, we were walking up the hill and I slid and it cut off like that much off of my foot. It was 108 that day, so the sand was scorching hot. I didn't feel it because I have neuropathy in my feet. So I got second degree burns on top of the cut.
High blood sugar can cause nerve damage or neuropathy. That's why Eddie didn't feel the gash on his foot. It led to gangrene in the bone, and he almost died from it. His left leg was amputated below the knee.
I went from being a very active person running amok to a person that was very limited in what I could do. It messed with me a lot emotionally and physically. I mean, it was hard. And it still is hard. Every day of my life is a challenge.
Eddie uses a wheelchair now. He spent last year in and out of the hospital with kidney failure, which led to congestive heart failure.
I could not breathe. Every time I lay down, I was drowning in my own liquids in my lungs because of all the fluids I had retained. I was in the hospital for a week that time, and that's when they said, Eddie, you need dialysis. And I was like, no, I'm not doing it, because that's a lifetime thing, and I don't want... He's like, either you die or you go on dialysis. And I was like, no, I said, I don't want to do it. My mom came in, she was crying. My cousins came in and were crying, and my sisters, and they made me realize, they're like, Eddie, we don't want you to die and stuff like that. And I was like, I don't want to die either, really.
Eddie made a tough decision. He chose life. Half his days are spent in kidney dialysis now. The rest of the time, he recovers at his government-subsidized apartment in downtown Sacramento.
These are all my medications that I got to take every morning.
He's on disability and Social Security income.
Every time I eat, I have to take these pills, so my phosphorus and my...
Eddie's diabetes is under control, but the damage has been done. He takes a dozen medications every day to stay alive. The pill bottles are strewn across his kitchen counter.
These are more of the same eating pills. Sleeping pills. People don't realize that diabetes is the silent killer. Like, it really will catch up with you. You know, I sit there and dwell sometimes, if I would have, could have, whatever. But, you know, you can't do that. Now you just got to live forward and do what you have to do to better your life.
You made it on time. Go ahead, write your name in. Flip it over and write it on the back.
Yes.
Yeah.
Eddie has found ways to give back. Twice a week, he volunteers at his apartment building for a program that serves food to low-income seniors.
Nicholson, right?
Yeah.
How many plates do we have?
25.
When I lost my leg and when I came here, they were so accepting of me. And at the time of that, I needed it. So I feel now I'm here for them.
Two more plates.
Eddie is clearly in his element at the registration table. He knows everyone who walks in by name.
Al's diabetic. Robert's an alcoholic diabetic. I don't want to say John's diabetic. John's, he's 86 years old. He lives his life freely. Like, I'm going to eat what I want anyways. I've lived this long.
He sits comfortably at the table, looking around at the characters slowly populating the room.
I get a fulfillment from seeing, like, all their different faces, different personalities, knowing that I'm doing a good deed.
Eddie often uses a wheelchair, but today he's walking with a slight hobble on a prosthetic limb. He stands to walk back to his apartment, and his broad shoulders tower over people sitting in the lobby. He makes them smile as he walks past.
You can ask Ken, he's diabetic, and I'm his doctor.
That's right.
He's good. I gave him some valuable information that saved his life.
I've given up all those things that I loved so much. It's still in my environment, like that stuff is still accessible to me at the stores, but I chose not to partake in giving into those things. So your environment does play a very big role in your decisions, but it always comes back to you. What do you want? What can you do? What is your choice?
Eddie Mendez is certainly not alone with his diabetes. Native American adults have one of the highest rates of the disease in the U.S. at 16%. Helen Maldonado is the California Area Diabetes Consultant for the Federal Indian Health Services Program. She says there's no single explanation for the higher rates among Native Americans, but there are known contributing factors, including genetics or epigenetics, conditions in the womb, and lifestyle and stress. Maldonado says diabetes has been devastating to American Indians, but there are healthcare interventions that bring hope.
Many people watch their family members die from diabetes or lose limbs or go through dialysis. It's been an epidemic with Native people.
We heard about the talking circles in the story. Also in the story, we heard one woman express resignation, really, about the fact that she had diabetes. She said she thought that it was part of God's plan. So do you hear this kind of fatalism, this sort of resignation that fate is predetermined in Native communities? And if so, how do you deal with it?
Yes, I've heard that quite a bit as a provider, and I always have to give the message of hope. Mm-hmm. We do have a program called the Diabetes Prevention Program in the Indian Health Service. There are 36 programs in the country that have been demonstrating that intensive lifestyle change has prevented diabetes in people. And also there's another initiative called the Healthy Heart. So people with diabetes are able to, with an intensive 16-week program, prevent any kind of heart disease.
Another one of the stories in the segment was about a man, Eddie, who says he didn't have access to medical care until he was an adult. Is this something that you hear a lot in the Native American community? And how does it come into play with the diabetes rates?
People have had access to care.
Mm-hmm.
There are Indian Health Service units across the country. In California, we only have tribal programs and urban programs. If they don't have access to care, that really does affect people dealing with diabetes. You need to have health care. You need to be able to get medication or whatever you need to take care of yourself. Currently, California is funded at 52.6% of the need. So there's a large unmet need for Indian health. It's something that affects all Native people. They may have a clinic that they can go to, but maybe they don't have enough gas money to get there.
It's very multi-layered.
Yes.
What are some of the cultural attitudes that might help diabetes management in the Native community? And on the flip side, are there also cultural attitudes that might hinder the management?
Talking circles are really good, and traditional dances and ceremonies. Prayer and being balanced in mind, body, and spirit really help. Hindrances, I think, is when community members or medical providers are not able to recognize their own behaviors based in historical trauma, and they make decisions that affect others. So they've forgotten their traditions. And I think the traditional way of dealing with illness or wellness is really important for all Native people to understand.
Research does suggest that culturally relevant care models can be the most successful in managing the diabetes epidemic. So what does culturally relevant care look like for the Native community?
It's patient-centered care designed around what the community wants. They would give their voice to the healthcare program saying, this is what we want from you. And to be able to hold their community gatherings, to be able to come together and have a relationship with a healthcare provider.
Helen Maldonado is the California Area Diabetes Consultant for the Indian Health Service. You'll find full-length interviews with health experts, including Helen Maldonado, facts about diabetes, and a video profile of Eddie Mendez at capradio.org/dealingwithdiabetes. Diabetes isn't a health problem just for America's oldest established populations, but for one of its newest, too. The fast-paced, fast-food American lifestyle can be tough on refugees. What traditional cultures have to teach us about healthy living, next on Dealing with Diabetes from Capital Public Radio. This is Dealing with Diabetes. I'm Pamela Wu. Diabetes is an epidemic in new ethnic communities like California's Hmong population. It's one of the largest in the country. For most of their long history, the Hmong people lived in the mountainous areas of China and Southeast Asia in a nearly pre-industrial world. In the 1970s, many began immigrating to the U.S. after the Vietnam War. Significant numbers of them settled in California's Central Valley, where they have a new life of opportunity and unhealthy temptation. Things like fast food, soft drinks, and candy, food that's very different from what their bodies are accustomed to. As Pauline Bartolone tells us, dealing with diabetes in the Hmong community is a family affair.
55-year-old Chia Chow Lo sits in front of a whiteboard teaching math to his 11-year-old adopted daughter.
Negative 2 times 5 equals negative 10. Negative 10 and positive 10 is not equal, okay?
Mr. Lo wears a camouflage cap, khaki pants, and a gray polo t-shirt. He's a thin, small man. He lectures about the importance of getting ahead in school.
You take this subject for elective to help your GPA break up. Understand?
I know.
He did the same with his older son, Fidan, who's 28 now and has his own kids. Fidan's visiting his parents today.
Before I went to preschool, he made sure I knew all my ABCs. I knew how to count to like 100.
Hurry up.
And I knew all my shapes and colors, and I started doing multiplication.
Fidan's dad is from Laos in Southeast Asia. He was enlisted by the U.S. government to serve against the communists during the Vietnam War. He came to the U.S. from a refugee camp in Thailand. Fidan helps translate his dad's story.
When they were living in Southeast Asia, they heard that in America there were like really good opportunities for achievement or for education. So he wanted to come first for that, and then secondly, he wanted to come to escape the communists.
There are now almost a quarter of a million Hmong people living in the United States, many of them in California's Central Valley. The Lo family lives in Sanger, a rural community just outside of Fresno. Their house is shrouded by trees in an otherwise flat, unshielded landscape. The family has about an acre of land to farm, some chickens, and a few dogs. Fidan's mom, Pa Vang Lo, is proud of the gardens that wrap around the house.
This is the rice.
Mm-hmm. This is the first time
I grew myself.
Yeah, I grew the rice herself, and so we had like a big harvest festival eating thing.
New rice, we call my mom Lechia. So it's so good. So for family, we just have that.
Mrs. Lo says they grow all the vegetables they eat. Corn, green beans, sweet potatoes, mustard greens. She's a busy woman. She works as a full-time nutrition aide, cooks, cares for their daughter, runs the garden, and takes care of her husband. He was diagnosed with diabetes about 10 years after he moved to the U.S. As Mr. Lo sits on a couch in their living room, his wife helps take his blood pressure. He points to his sagging left eye.
This one is plastic, no. Blind. Left eye very blind.
So it's bleeding a lot in his eye. So that's why they do the surgery, and that's what caused by the diabetes.
Diabetes also caused Mr. Lo's kidneys to fail years ago. Since then, he's been dependent on dialysis. He chooses to do the treatment at home. 4 half-hour sessions a day. First, Mr. Lo drains yellow waste fluid using a tube attached to a hole in his abdomen. Then he introduces a fresh bag of dialysis fluid into his body, and it sits there until the next dialysis treatment. The process removes toxins from the blood, a job healthy kidneys normally do.
So it's sucking everything out. So he's not pee anymore, he only poop.
No more pee.
So
I still have kidney in there, but the kidney dead.
The health complications of diabetes largely keep Mr. Lo housebound.
You like beer? Good.
Many Hmong say they didn't know diabetes back in Laos and Thailand. Mr. Lo says food, physical activity, health, everything is different here in the U.S.
In Laos, they had to walk a lot. They didn't have cars, and everywhere they went, they just had to walk. He also said that as soldiers, even in Laos, it's a poor country. They didn't have a lot to eat anyways, and they did a lot of physical activities. In contrast, coming to the United States, everywhere you go, You don't get to walk a lot. You just drive to every place you go. On top of that, the food here, they make it too good. There's a lot of fat in the meats that they have here. They use preservatives for the food to preserve it for longer periods. He says that once they came here, those foods taste way better than what they had in Laos. So they consumed more, and they also consume more sweets like sugary drinks like Coke and Pepsi.
After his diagnosis, friends and family encouraged Mr. Lo to use traditional Hmong healing practices. At first, they got help from a shaman and used herbal remedies.
Hmong belief system was that maybe it's because of your spirit, or maybe it's because of something you did, or maybe it's because your ancestors are not happy with you. So you had to do maybe spiritual callings or shamanistic rituals to try to remedy those things. But he said that even after all of those, it didn't work. So the Hmong people would be like, well, maybe you need to try these types of herbal medicine or these root types of medicine from trees or stuff to help you out. But after he took a lot of those, it also didn't help him.
Mr. and Mrs. Lo have embraced Western medicine. They test his blood sugar once a day. Mrs. Lo says measuring glucose levels is essential for keeping her husband's diabetes under control.
Yeah.
They say they've abandoned the spiritual healing practices of the Hmong, but Mr. Lo occasionally tries new herbal remedies. That's one of the reasons there's sometimes tension between the couple.
181. Yeah. Hi.
Did you take your pill?
Not yet.
See? Okay, you're busy.
Mrs. Lo chops beans from her garden for this Saturday morning meal. Cooking for her husband's health has required some experimentation.
He has a diabetes, so I learned that each time he eats the regular rice, make his sugar going up very, very high. And sticky rice is make like more higher. The sugar is stay more longer. But when I change my way to be like brown rice with almost 2 meals or 3 meals, we are be able to be control his sugar down lower.
Mrs. Lo says she's the one who likes change. Her son says she was one of the first people in their community to cook brown rice for the family. But they didn't always like it. Mrs. Lo not only had to learn how to make healthier food, but how to get her husband to eat it.
I don't really tell him that this is only for you, but I said it's for family, but you need to eat a little bit more. So every time I make meals, I don't make special for him. Everyone needs to eat the same.
But Mr. Lo still has an appetite for unhealthy foods, a tendency his wife is constantly keeping in check. Ultimately, he realizes she's keeping him alive.
When he finds out that a lot of his age group has passed away, he feels that they didn't have a really strong support group. He said their wives must not take care of them as well as my mom has taken care of him. And that's probably why they've all passed away before he has.
Like I say, if she don't take care of me or I don't take care good enough, I already die many times. Those who dialyze after me already die. One died 2009, one died 2008, one died just this year.
The Lo family is giving us a glimpse inside their lives and how they're dealing with diabetes. But compared to other ethnic groups, there isn't a lot of current data about diabetes in the Hmong community. One of the few people tracking this is Dr. Diane Baker with the Sacramento State School of Nursing. She's been doing research on Hmong health issues for 2 decades.
General estimates are that Diabetes in the Hmong community is around 16 to 20%, which is almost double that found in the European American community. One study in Minnesota indicated levels as high as 41% either identified with diabetes or at significant risk, we call a pre-diabetic state. So the impact is huge and growing.
Now, you were involved with a community assessment done through the Hmong Women's Heritage Association. Fidan, one of the people we just heard from in our previous segment, helped to gather information through those surveys and focus groups. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
Diabetes is devastating the Hmong community. There's definitely an awareness of the impact of diabetes. We also found there's a lack of basic access to care for the Hmong. They are an underinsured group, and when they are actually able to get to care, there's a lack of trust with the Western healthcare providers. So even when they get recommendations for care, it's hard for them to follow up and do what's being recommended. We found that only 13% had ever had a foot check, which should be a standard of care. 30% had had recommended dilated eye exams, which should be done annually, so that's a way under what our target would ideally be. 38% were not aware of their A1C levels, and everyone with diabetes should know what their A1C is because it tells you how your diabetes and glucose levels have been managed over time. So in none of these cases were the Hmong even getting 50% of the care that they should be getting, and there's a variety of reasons for that. One of which is that a lot of the care is being offered through the safety net clinics, and they just don't have the resources.
You've already cited some pretty astonishing numbers, rates from 16 to 20%, as high as 41% in one study. In your experience, why are the diabetes rates so high?
Well, there's almost a perfect storm. When you have refugee groups that come in from very high energy agrarian societies and they arrive in the United States and they quickly have a very sedentary lifestyle, there's a risk factor there. The variety and depth of food that they're used to is highly impacted. Certainly fast food plays into this. And then there's also genetic factors. There's a protective gene that has been identified in many of the persons of Asian heritage that actually sort of prepares you for having low food resource. But when you come to an area where there's high food resource, suddenly that gene's working against you. So even typical diets can allow you to gain weight. And of course, weight gain is a high risk factor for diabetes. All those factors play into it. And then there's just the issues related to depression and being in refugee status and isolation and a sense of loneliness.
You mentioned depression. Fidan Lo says that depression is rampant in the Hmong community. And this also is a problem with other Southeast Asian groups who are coming from war-torn countries. How does this affect their diabetes management?
It's hard to take care of yourself when you're depressed. It also is difficult because when the depression is treated, now you've added another layer of medication onto the regime for diabetes. So you have a population that's somewhat distrustful of Western medicine. They're not wanting to take all these pills. And now there's even more medication and more pills. So care for diabetes has to be multifaceted. We have to improve our cultural competency and outreach. We have to look at these comorbid conditions, such as the relationship between depression and diabetes, if we're going to be effective in making a difference.
Dr. Diane Baker is with the Sacramento State School of Nursing. Fidan Lo is making a difference in the Hmong community. He lives in Sacramento now with his own family, but often visits his parents near Fresno. His father instilled in him the value of education, and now he's paying it back. He received an advanced degree in public health. As Pauline Bartolone tells us, he's putting it to good use, helping others.
This is just some sample AmeriCorps grants.
At the Hmong Women's Heritage Association in South Sacramento, Fidan Lo heads up research and grant writing for their community diabetes work. He knows from experience that it takes a lot to manage and reverse chronic disease.
If you want to treat somebody with diabetes, then really your environment has to change, and it starts with your family.
Through surveys and focus groups, the Hmong Association gathered much-needed information to help combat diabetes in their community.
They really, really would like to see a lot more programs that has activities for older folks out there. They want a safe place to exercise. They also want a safe place to just mingle and socialize.
In late October, a community health worker named Jua Lo led the association's first diabetes workshop with Fidan. More than 20 people attended, most of them diabetic. As they explained the basics of diabetes, the older crowd listened intently. None took notes, but they weren't shy about asking questions.
I didn't expect that many people to show up, and I didn't expect that response from the Hmong community because they're generally really, really shy. So they actually came out of the shell.
So that's our upper body.
An independent health educator showed simple ways to be more active at home. Jua translated, using the English word for exercise. There's no such word in the Hmong language.
At home with a chair in front of the...
Soon they were all on their feet, lifting arms and legs to music. There was blushing and smiling.
A lot of people were laughing, especially during the exercising routine, because, you know, They don't exercise much, you know, so like exercising might be a little funny to them, but I think they enjoyed it a lot.
Fidan joined them. He was one of the youngest people in the room.
I think me and my dad, we are a lot alike too, so we like to teach, we like to encourage people.
Fidan says this is the first time people here have been taught about diabetes. He hopes it won't be the last time they hear the health educator's words.
Don't let diabetes control your life. You control yourself, so don't let diabetes control your life.
3, 4, 5, 5 more, 6, almost 7.
In the search for solutions to community health issues, it's clear that one size does not fit all. Fidan Lo and others are finding ways to customize solutions for individuals while engaging their communities, so they're not just coping with diabetes, they're changing for the better. Dealing with Diabetes was produced by Pauline Bartolone, Catherine Stifter, Paul Conley, and Alan Ray. Multimedia and web content by Andrew Nixon and Veronica Nagy. Executive producer Joe Barr. Music by Scott Collard, Kevin Moore, and Stars of the Lid. You'll find much more online, including diabetes resources, videos, slideshows, and a place for you to comment at capradio.org/dealingwithdiabetes. Support for this program was provided by the California Endowment and the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm Pamela Wu. Dealing with Diabetes was produced by Capital Public Radio, Sacramento.